The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. Welcome, everybody. Very excited to be here. Thank you, everyone, for your attendance. We have a very good evening tonight. We have a bill. We have Senate File 2620 and the House file yet to be determined, but we have a pension bill in front of you. Okay. So I thought how this night would work is we will go through the bill, have staff go through the bill. And members, we have in your packets, we have a summary, a legislative summary. We have the spreadsheet. We have an A1 amendment that I'd like to introduce Mr. Eric Nauman, our nonpartisan research fiscal analyst, I should say. I work very closely with him on many issues, especially pensions. And then we're going to have Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth go through the bill, a quick review. We'll have the directors of the plans come up and give their opinion of the bill, any changes that need to be said. And then we'll have Mr. Nauman go through the A1 amendment and the spreadsheet. We will take public testimony next week, and we'll take any changes, amendments, and members, and to you all, too, in the audience. I did take a few liberties on this bill because some decisions needed to be made in a very short, timely fashion. So I did get counsel and did go ahead and give the okay on these changes. There is nothing that I don't think a lot of you don't know about, but I do respect the opinion of the commission and all of you out there. And if there's changes, amendments that need to be had, we're going to address those next Tuesday evening. Okay? So we'll leave time for a healthy discussion with that. Before I turn it over to Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth, I first like a motion on the minutes from last week.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, we need a correction on the minutes.
Oh.
It states that senators present was Senator Schoen.
Thank you.
That was Senator Friends.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Pappas.
So I move the minutes with that correction.
Yes, with the correction of Senator Friends instead of Senator Schoen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay. With that, I am going to turn it over to Ms. Lincheski and Ms. Barth to give us a rundown of Senate File 545, the difference in this bill. The Senate File 545 was last year. This is Senate File 2620. Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if we're going to follow along, should we follow along with the summary in the packet or with the actual bill?
The summary?
Summary, okay.
And that's all in your packet, members.
Thank you.
Ms. Lincheski.
Madam Chair, Commission, LCPR staff has prepared 5 documents for your review that are unrelated to fiscal matters. The first is the 10-page summary memo, and I'm going to loosely go through about half of that. Rachel will take over from there and take us through the rest of the memo and into a 6-page chart that is a comparison of the 2017 bills and the 2018 bills. So along with the summary memo, we also have a table of contents page that is intended to help you find sections as we're talking about them in the bill. The comparison chart, and then we have a section-by-section summary that's similar to what we've done in past years. That's a 22-page summary and is very detailed, but if you're interested in something in particular, that's the place to look. And then finally, we have a 2-page list of source legislation, and these are the individual bills that were put into bills in the omnibus bill in 2016 and 2017. There is one deletion or one error on that in that document, which is number 14 on page 1 of that, and that indicates that there's an unclassified plan change, and that was the pension provision that has made it into law in the last 2 years. It has to do with an unclassified plan, a grandfathering rule that allows people to retire under more generous assumptions. So just noting that there was one change in the last 2 years, and that is still listed on our source legislation. So I'll highlight some of the items that are in the summary memo. First, just mention that sustainability measures have been introduced by the plans going back to just prior to the 2016 legislative session. This was all sort of brought on by the completion of 6-year experience studies by the big plans, MSRS General, Para General, and TRA. Those studies indicated that people were living longer, therefore there were more liabilities associated with that. As well, the actuaries for the plans indicated that the investment rate of return should be dropped to somewhere in the range of 7 to 8% rather than where they currently are. The 2016 bill then included many of the changes that the plans had brought forward. It did not include any appropriations, so when it reached the governor, it was vetoed because it only had COLA reductions and did not have that funding piece. The 2017 bill is very similar to the bill in front of us now. It includes appropriations as well as some state aids. It also includes benefit reforms and many, many administrative and technical changes. So I'll start on really, I guess, page 2 of the summary to note that the first part of the bill are the benefit reforms. Reforms include the elimination of augmentation. And augmentation, you may recall from discussions over the past couple of years, is a cost of living adjustment that is automatically given to the benefits that have been accrued by former employees. So this is the case where someone leaves employment, cannot take their pension until they reach an early or normal retirement age. Their pension then is automatically increased by what we call augmentation. That benefit or additional feature is eliminated by the bill, effective July 1, 2018. In addition, we are removing augmentation from the way early retirement benefits are calculated. Currently, there is an add-back for augmentation at 2.5% or 3% to kind of, I guess, roughly approximate the augmentation that an early retiree would otherwise have received had the retiree waited to take his benefit or her benefit until normal retirement age. This subsidy is removed over a 5-year period from the calculation of early retirement benefits for, again, the three big plans and St. Paul teachers. The rate of interest on refunds is reduced from 4% to 3%. These are refunds that employees can take where they take their employee contributions out with interest and then forfeit the pension that would otherwise have been paid when they reach retirement age. In addition to those benefit reforms, there are a number of COLA changes. The first is really just COLA reductions. So this is a huge money-saving move. The COLAs are reduced for many of the plans. The summary lists what those reductions are. Those also appear in Article 5 of the bill. The one other big change has to do with a proposal that PARA has come forward with. So it is a somewhat of a reduction in the COLAs, but more importantly, it's a way of tying the COLA to inflation. Doug Anderson at PARA will come up and explain that in detail after we finish this overview. In addition, COLAs are in the bill. The COLAs, the first COLA is postponed until normal retirement age. So instead of beginning at early retirement age, when a person begins a benefit prior to normal retirement age, their COLA would have begun immediately. Under the bill, it does not begin until normal retirement age. That change will not take effect until January 1, 2024. So there's a delayed effective date to that. The COLA triggers, which we've talked about for the last couple of years, these are automatic increases in the COLA when certain funding thresholds are achieved. Those are removed from the bill because of the kind of odd effect that they have on the plans. As we get closer to better funding, there's a setback in the actuarial status of the plan because the trigger is getting closer. So the COLA triggers are repealed. In addition, there's a requirement that the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement, this group, review COLAs and determine whether the way COLAs are currently being determined is still appropriate or whether there are other methods, including the method that PARA is looking to adopt in this bill. In addition, as I mentioned earlier, the bill does reduce the investment rate of return from the current rate of 8% for all the plans except TRA, which is at 8.5%. The reduction is down to 7.5% for all the plans. The governor's blue ribbon panel, as well as the plan, as well as the plan's actuaries, have all recommended that the rate of return assumption be reduced. So that is what the bill does. In addition, all the plans use an amortization period. It had been 30 years, but they've slowly been sort of paying that down. We are now resetting that 30-year amortization period in the bill, so everybody will reach 100% funding by 2048. If all assumptions are met and if actuarially required contributions are made each year. Let's see, Article 7 of the bill contains all the contribution increases. Those are set out in charts on page 5, 6, and 7. I should note first, though, that these contribution stabilizer provisions, which allow the boards of the plans to adjust contribution rates on their own decision with the review of the commission, those provisions have been repealed by the bill. This is similar to what was set forth in the 2017 bill. I won't go through the contribution increases. They're pretty clearly, I think, laid out here in these charts that are also colorful. So hopefully it would be pretty clear. The blue part of the chart, those charts are for employee contribution increases. The green headed chart is for employer contribution increases. Moving on to page 7, Article 8 of the bill contains direct state aids. These are the $4.5 million to para, police, and fire for 2 years, followed by an ongoing annual direct aid of $9 million, and St. Paul Teachers, a $5 million annual state aid that will begin in FY19 and continue on. Oh, and with regard to the contribution increases, I should also note that both TRA and St. Paul Teachers are on a similar six-year schedule. They will increase their employer contribution by 0.21% each year, except for in the first 2 years for St. Paul. In addition to the 0.21, St. Paul employer contributions will increase by an additional 0.625. So as you can see in the chart, the first year's increase will be 0.835%, followed by the same increase in FY20, thereafter at 0.21%. And this is because this funding change is being paid for by the pension adjustment revenue provisions that I'm not at all familiar with, but Eric Nauman is, and we'll be talking about those that provision in a little bit. Appropriations are also included in Article 21 of the bill, and as I mentioned, Eric Nauman will be going into that in detail.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then the next big chunk of the bill is on page 8. Deals with volunteer firefighter provisions, and most of the language in Articles 15 and 17 consists of the recommendations from the State Auditor's Working Group and just mostly bring the statutes into conformity with current practices. And then just to highlight some of the provisions that came over from the 2016 and 2017 bills include the City of Austin Fire State Aid Allocation Provision, the Cromwell-Wright Fire Department merger, and then fixes the benefit issue that we heard about last year with the City of Brook Park. And then one of the bigger changes that I will discuss right now in this section relates to the maximum amount lump sum relief associations are able to offer to their firefighters. This is the amount that is multiplied by a firefighter's years of service to come up with the lump sum provided at retirement. So in 2016, the City of Eden Prairie had a special bill that allowed them to increase this amount from the current $10,000 a year to $15,000. It was eventually expanded to general law, which is what we saw in the 2016 and 2017 bills. And it would apply to all eligible relief associations. There are certain requirements that they have to meet before they can offer that high of an amount. But over the past 2 years, stakeholders have indicated that benefit amounts is a larger scope issue that will require more time to look into. So in this year's version of the bill, the 2018 current version of the bill, the provision only applies to Eden Prairie, which has the support of both the city and the firefighters.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas?
Just a brief technical question on the bottom of page 8. I've actually never heard of the city of Brook Park. Is that supposed to be Brooklyn Park, or is there really a city called Brook Park?
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, there is. I think their population is like 800. It's very small.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yes.
Sorry.
And that wasn't a village.
Yeah, very small. All right.
Ms. Barth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So number 9 on the summary just discusses the individuals and small group bills. They're all the same. They've carried over from 2016 and 2017. These provisions were all approved by the commission, and they just fix employer errors that resulted in exclusion from pension plans. MNSCU employees seeking TRA coverage, Duluth Township clerk seeking parageneral coverage, and then just a group of MnDOT employees who would like Rule of 90. Number 10 deals with the Fairview issue that was in last year's bill. The provisions, which again are the same, reduce the enhanced rate of augmentation for former employees of the University of Minnesota Hospital and Clinics under MSRS General who were transferred to private employment with Fairview Hospital. So the rate, which is currently 5.5 or 7.5, depending on the individual's age, will reduce by 0.75% each year until the rate is zero, which will recur January 1, 2025. And then number 11 on the list of page 9 is just miscellaneous and technical changes. So these are technical changes that we have found, the revisor's office has found, the plan's administrative bills over the last 2 years that have all been approved in 2016 and 2017. So page 10, which discusses new provisions, I would like you to please turn to attachment B, which is this chart titled Pension Bill Version Comparison. A nice segue. Yes, attachment B. So this highlights the provisions in the bill, the current bill, that either changed from one of last year's versions of the bill or is entirely new. So this is just to give everybody an idea of what is different in this year's bill compared to the last two. We've received a lot of questions about the differences and thought this would just be an easier way to kind of highlight which bills seem to be important last year and then current bill. So again, the chart only shows substantive changes. We are not dealing with technical changes or like date changes or anything like that. So these are just big substantive changes. So the first column is for Senate File 545, which is in the third engrossment, which was the version that the Senate passed unanimously during the regular session and contained what we have been referring to as the Schoen Amendment. And then the middle column is for Senate File 3, which was passed by both the House and the Senate during the special session, but was vetoed by the governor. And then the last column is the current bill, so the 2018 pension bill as it is right now. Okay. So in general, the biggest changes amongst the bills occurred for PARA and TRA, MSRS, and St. Paul teachers remained mostly the same. I'm just gonna try to highlight the differences between the versions. So to begin with, on the first page, dealing with benefit reforms, there were no benefit reforms for PARA in either of last year's bills, so neither Senate File 545 or 3. There was only a requirement that the PARA board come up with benefit reform proposals for the 2018 session. The current version of the bill includes all the benefit changes that Susan went over for PARA. And then for TRA, Senate File 545 included all the benefit changes, but only became effective if money was provided to fund the employer contribution increase, which is what was the Schoen Amendment, as we've been discussing. The TRA benefit reforms were removed in Senate File 3 because there was no funding, and then in the current version of the bill, all the benefit reforms have been put back in without that conditional effective date. So the next page for assumption changes, which are the lowering of the investment return assumption and extending the amortization period. The only difference among the three versions of the bill were TRA. So in Senate File 545, the assumption changes for TRA were included, but again, only if funding was provided. So in Senate File 3, those changes fell out. And then in the current bill, all of those changes are once again put back in without that conditional effective date. So the third page is dealing with the COLA changes. All three versions of the bill include the same COLA changes for MSRS and St. Paul teachers. So removing those triggers and lowering or freezing COLAs. Senate File 545 and Senate File 3 lowered the paracorrectional COLA and removed triggers, for all the plans but the general plan. The current version of the bill removes the triggers for all the plans and implements that new COLA methodology, which Doug Anderson will discuss a little bit later, but that's based on the COLA that's provided by Social Security. And then for TRA, Senate File 545 included COLA reforms again, only if funding was provided. So those fell out in Senate File 3. And in the current version of the bill, those COLA changes are back in without that conditional effective date. Contribution increases, which Susan already went into pretty much detail, didn't really change a whole lot. For MSRS, the big change was changing the unclassified contribution increases. In Senate File 545 and Senate File 3, those were at 5.5 and 6. In this bill, there the employee will go up with the general plan because those will be tied due to federal law, and the employer will go up by 0.25. And then for TRA, again, the contribution increases were included. However, they were contingent on funding. Senate File 3, those fell out. There was no funding. And in the current version, they are put back in without that conditional effective date. And then as Susan mentioned, for St. Paul, the employer contribution in both Senate File 545 and 3 were being phased in over 4 years. In this current version of the bill, it will be over 6 years. All right, and then the last, well, not the last page. So direct state aids, the amounts of all direct state aids remain the same in all three versions of the bill. The only difference is adding a definite end date for when the aid shuts off. So in the current version of the bill, all new and current direct state aids shut off when the respective plan either reaches a specified funded ratio on an actuarial value of assets or July 1, 2048. Which is all the plans' amortization dates under this bill, so whichever occurs first. And then I've already discussed for volunteer firefighters the Eden Prairie provision, which was, as I said, general legislation in Senate File 545 and 3, and is now back to only applying to Eden Prairie. And then the last page, which I'm not going to go too far into because hopefully we have Eric Nauman with us. So the pension adjustment revenue was not in Senate File 545 or Senate File 3. It has now been added into this current version of the bill, and it will fund both TRA and St. Paul's employer contribution increases over that six-year phase-in that we've discussed. And then finally, for appropriations, all three versions of the bill provided funding to help offset MSRS employer contribution increases. Senate File 545 and 3 provided funding through appropriations for St. Paul teachers, but the new version of the bill is going to provide that funding through the pension adjustment revenue. And then last year's two bills, well, Senate File 545 and the current bill both provide funding for agencies with TRA coverage through an appropriation, but Senate File 3 did not. So that's my overview of the differences. If there are any questions?
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Barth. Ms. Lancheski, you guys did a wonderful job. I really liked the way you organized this, made sense of the differences between last year's bill and this year's bill. And members, we do have a House File Number 3053. I'm sorry, I didn't see that. Yeah, so we are set to go. As you can see, members, there was some decisions, especially on the sunset and on the COLA and the pension adjustment formula, that was decisions that were made. And so we can have a healthy discussion on anything here going forward. But first, I would like to have some testimony from the fund directors. And Ms. Schertz, we're going to start with you. You always seem to be put to the last, so you're going to be up front first this time.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. I think by my calculations, over 2 years of going last, I think I have about 2 hours worth of testimony then. I think that would be fair.
I think we're looking at maybe like 20 seconds.
No. I'll try to keep this very brief. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Jill Schertz. I'm the Executive Director of the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association. I'm joined tonight by my colleague, Christine McDonald, the Deputy Director. We would like to very briefly talk about our organization, our board, and our membership's view of the bill, highlight a few key provisions, and explain again in very high-level detail why it's important. But first, we think it's really important to stop and say thank you on behalf of the 12,000 members of St. Paul Teachers, and I'm sure many others will express a similar sentiment. The bill that we're considering today is represents incredible public policy. It is really important for the pension plans of Minnesota, and we're deeply grateful. We realize that we have some miles left to go before we hit the finish line, but the fact that we are here at this point in time is remarkable and very appreciated. You know, in particular, we want to just take a second to thank a number of people who have worked very hard over the last couple of years, largely behind the scenes, and that's the staff of the LCPR who have been professional, dedicated, and skilled, the Senate and House staffers who work constantly with not only the legislators but their colleagues and the caucuses and all of us, MMB staff who worked hard to provide the funding and make sure that we came to a bipartisan solution. Our board members and our members generally, who have been deeply thoughtful about this and resolute as to the need. And then finally, all of you, not only legislators generally, but this commission, you've maintained an open door throughout this entire process. You have been open-minded and challenging about this, but you have committed a tremendous amount of time and energy and resources to making this happen and getting us to this point. So we're very grateful. I would comment that for those in the room that maybe have a life outside of pensions that are lucky enough, this may seem like a large bill coming together all of a sudden, but all of this, us in this room, I think, know it's been about 3 years in the making and a tremendous amount of effort. And in that time, it really represents the work of a lot of constituents, bipartisan, Republican, and DFL, House and Senate. Additionally, I'm very pleased it represents a lot of intergenerational cooperation, retirees and actives working together, and frankly, employers, labor, districts, and teachers. All of this driving towards one really important goal, and that's the stability of Minnesota's pension plans. So we're very proud and pleased of where we've landed so far. We think it represents good, effective public policy, true bipartisanship, and a principled solution to a keenly important public policy issue. And at the end of the day, what we try to keep an eye on is that it takes into account the needs of all of our stakeholders. And when we think about our stakeholders and for whom we're financial stewards, we think of our members, obviously, our employers, obviously. But we also, that must be Brian Rice.
That's all. Mr. Rice.
But importantly, we also think about the taxpayer, and we think this bill includes them as a part of the conversation. So when we think about our touchstones to this year's bill, they remain the same: stability, maintaining core benefits, and financial stewardship. So with that, I'll just touch briefly on what we think are some of the highlights about why this is a good bill and why we support it. It supports and facilitates important plan structural changes. You've heard a lot about them, so I won't spend time on them, but moving to 7.5% investment return assumption represents a key conservative move on the investment side. I think it does a lot to ensure long-term stability. Recognizing realistic assumptions on mortality and the fact that we are paying members who are living longer, which increases our costs. Importantly, and you know, I can't stress this enough, it not only recognizes these costs, but you've heard it provides really substantial funding towards those costs. And then an acknowledgement of that substantial funding, it also represents a very balanced approach to sharing the benefits and burdens in terms of cost-effective measures. And we'll talk about those in a second. At the end of the day, what this bill does is it takes this plan to full funding by the end of the amortization period, which is absolutely critical. Spend just 1 second revisiting why we are here. I commend the board and the fund. They've taken a conservative approach for a number of years. They've kept their COLA at 1%. They've made tough choices on benefits, but maintaining core benefits all along the way. And in that effort, they've taken their deficiency since 2012 to about 6%, all the way down to 0.5%, which is, and again, in our business, is about a rounding error. But if we stop there, it's not the whole story. When we recognize, kind of do the pro forma on where we really are, taking into account these assumption changes and mortality, what we're really looking at and what we have to acknowledge is about a 4% deficiency. And what we really have to look at is it would take our funded ratio to just below 60%, but more importantly, it would take the long-term trajectory of the fund in a downward path to about 55%, and that is not a sustainable place to be. So that compels us to act and has resulted in the bill that we have before us. You've heard the highlights. I'll just hit on a few again. In terms of costs, we recognize the costs of the assumption changes, but we balance that with significant savings that result from eliminating the COLA triggers, recognizing that we'll take a reduction in our COLA for 2 years of 1%, deferring or delaying the start of a COLA till normal retirement age, but making a good policy trade-off about how to allocate our scarce resources, so still protecting our employees and our members that have dedicated a full career to the fund, so it exempts our 6230s and our rule of 90s. And you've heard about the others, removing augmentation from the deferred and resetting our amortization. So all of these are very important and key cost-saving measures, and at the end of the day, the balance for that is funding over 6 years, and it's significant funding. 2.5% on the employer contribution increase to take us to 9% from 6.5, $5 million in direct funding, and an employee contribution increase of 0.25% after fiscal year 23. Again, all of that takes us to full funding over the amortization period, which represents best practices and represents long-term stability for these 12,000 members. So with that, I would just say thank you. We support this bill, we support your efforts in it, and we thank you for your support.
Members, any questions? Ms. Schertz. Ms. Schertz, would you just like to explain why we increased the employer contribution from 4 years to 6 years? The explanation behind that, please.
Absolutely. You know, I think it's representative of the give and take throughout this process that we appreciate. When the employer contribution moved from an allocation to the pension adjustment formula, in order to have some parallelism, we moved to a 6 years, and we agreed with that. But what we had an active discussion about was the economic impact of moving to 6 years. In the prior iteration of the bill, we had been at 4 years. We made the argument, and I appreciate the fact that you were willing to listen to it. With a fund that has been trending in the 60s, we needed funding on the earlier side, that would move the needle faster. So with that, we reached a compromise where half of the 2.5% would be accelerated in 2 years, but the remainder would be paced out over six. And we think that's a fair compromise. What that accomplishes is in the first 2 years, we actually have slightly more funding in return for a slower pacing in the 6 years. And it allows it to come out in the pension adjustment formula. So we thought that was a very good compromise.
Questions on that, members? Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Ms. Schertz. Ms. McDonald, do you have anything that you'd like to contribute?
No, I have been here through this process and have worked for the organization for about 15 years, and 10 years prior to that for the state auditor's office. So fiscal responsibility is always on my mind, and this feels good for our members and for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you very much for your work on this, and very, very well said, Ms. Schertz, on all those to thank your members and your board, and I'd like to thank them, too,
great,
for their
thank
work.
Thank you.
You bet. With that, we are going to go to TRA, Mr. Jay Stoffel. Mr. Stoffel.
Good evening. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Lisa is passing out a one-pager that I'll refer to as we get into it here. I'll begin by saying, reiterating Jill's comments about the thanks that goes around to everybody that's worked on this. We really appreciate it. All of you are very important in the process. We appreciate the time and the effort you're putting in, Pension Commission staff, House and Senate research staff, and our stakeholder groups are always very much at the table, discussing, working out ideas. So thanks to all the parties that are involved in the process. So my name is Jay Stoffel. I am the executive director of the TRA, and I'm here to express support for Senate File 2620. The TRA board has worked hard with the legislature in 2016 and 2017 to pass sustainability legislation. It is needed, it's important, and we're here again in 2018 to try again. Thank you, Senator Rosen, for your leadership on these issues. After last session, you told us you would begin where we left off last year, and you have been true to your word. Senate File 2620 is pretty much what we expected to see, with a few minor changes, but thank
exactly
you very much.
Sure, that's what I said, Mr. But it was pretty close. No.
It was close to that.
It was close.
Okay. So the TRA board in the last 9 months has been very busy with several things. We conducted a mini experience study of our economic assumptions. Our actuaries delivered a report in November recommending a new set of assumptions, including an investment return assumption of 7.5%. In December, the TRA board approved those recommended actuarial assumptions, and we requested the Pension Commission to approve the set of assumptions, and last week you did that. So thank you for that action. Also, over the last 9 months, we've worked very hard and continuously with all of our stakeholder groups. We meet just about every month, sometimes multiple times in a month, with our active working members, our retirees groups, our employers and their representatives appearing at their events. We accept just about every invitation that comes our way to speak in front of any of those groups. We feel it's important to be in touch and to offer information. So we've been very busy with that, discussing what happened in 2017 and how to approach the 2018 session. And then finally, we directed our actuaries to look at Senate File 545, which we, Senate File 3, which we were not part of, but to cost out using 2017 actuarial data, census data that we have, and the 2017 investment experience. So the numbers we have are completely up to date with the most recent, with the best information we have on the demographics of the plan and the finances of the plan. So everything is up to date, and that's what we've been sharing with you, your staff, MMB, and the House and Senate research staff. So after months of discussion, I can tell you today that the TRA board will support Senate File 2620. The primary changes in the bill are very close to what we proposed in our own bill last year. There are some provisions in Senate File 2620 that are not endorsed by the TRA board, but the bill in its entirety is acceptable and it should pass. As for our stakeholder groups, they are looking forward for the opportunity next week to voice their own opinions, but I have been told that they will support the bill if it's funded. Each of the groups can also identify something in the bill that they don't endorse, but overall they believe it's a workable solution. For the analysis that I've handed out, if you look at page one, I'll sort of quickly go through the provisions. LCPR staff did this to a very high level, but I'll go in a little bit deeper, not too much. But on side one, A and B relate to the COLA provisions. We're reducing our cost of living adjustments and delaying receipt of cost of living adjustments until normal retirement age. Items C and D eliminate augmentation in deferred benefits and early retirement factors. Item E is an increase in employee contributions. Item F is an increase in the employer contributions. And G resets our amortization period to a new 30-year period to the year 2048. And you can see all of those changes combined reduce the actuarially required contribution rate by 6.16%. Today, we're just over 7% deficient. So this takes care of 6.16% of that deficiency. But I think, and that's significant, but in terms of dollars, this bill will reduce our unfunded liability by $2 billion. So it is a very significant pension bill. It does significant things. It involves everyone in the plan, and it's significant dollars that are being reduced on the liability side of the equation. If you look in the side two of the page, you can see how that translates as far as how the actuarial presentation works. The very first line, actuarial accrued liability. Without this bill, we have a liability of $30.3 billion. When the bill passes, our liability will be $28.3 billion. There's the $2 billion reduction right there the day the bill passes. Our assets are $21 billion. So, again, today, without the bill, we're $9 billion unfunded, $7 billion unfunded with the bill, 70% versus 75% funded when the bill passes. And again, most importantly, we are 70% funded on its, at today, that looks close to the average, but what's worrisome is the direction that we're heading. So we're projected to be 52% funded in 30 years without any sustainability measures. With this bill, we will be on track, if all assumptions are met, to be at 92% funded in 30 years. So that's a significant improvement and really gets the plan going in the right direction. On the contribution side, we currently have a deficiency of 7.14%. That's simply the difference between what the actuaries are telling us need to come into the plan and what the statutory rates are. So we're 7.14%, which I like to point out isn't just purely made up by contribution rate increases, but we're doing this very balanced way with benefit reductions and contribution increases. So with the bill, we would be left with a small 1% deficiency. So I would point out that in 30 years' time, what we're doing doesn't really get us 100% funded. We will still, if all assumptions come in right on target, we will still be a bit short, but 92% ain't bad. It gets us really going in the right direction. And all kidding aside, this is very important legislation. It's really needed. We really appreciate the work and the effort that has gone into it. So, we would really appreciate getting the bill moved on. We will work with you through the rest of the process and look forward to continued discussions.
Thank you, Mr. Stoffel. That was very well said, too. And thank you for doing your mini experience study. I think that was a game changer. And you were very open and transparent about that earlier this year, so I appreciate that. Members, any questions for Mr. Stoffel? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stoffel, once again, I just want to make sure I heard what I thought I heard, and if you would reiterate, did I hear that the TRA board and stakeholders have endorsed the TRA proposal that's in the bill that the commission is putting forward?
Mr. Stoffel.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, the TRA board, I'll speak first to that question, will support Senate File 2620. The stakeholder groups, I am told, we met as recently as Monday with the last group that I still needed to have some discussion with. And again, I can't speak for all the stakeholder groups. They will speak for themselves on Tuesday next week. But my understanding is we have all of our stakeholder groups behind Senate File 2620.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stoffel, I appreciate your work and your efforts on that, and I'll charge you with holding the coalition together until such time that the governor signs the bill.
Oh, boy. Okay. Well,
the job of you. The executive director, Mr.
Yes.
Stoffel, I'm just saying. Further comments, questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Stoffel.
Welcome.
Nice work.
Thanks.
Mr. Anderson, executive director for PERA. PERA, you have a little longer presentation because you've been doing some work. We sent you back last year to do a sustainability package within the parameters of the benefit reforms that we had in place. And Mr. Anderson, you stepped up to the plate, and we appreciate that. So,
thank you, Madam Chair and Commission members. And I think Ms. Schertz did a beautiful job of saying thank you and everything, so I would just want to repeat that and say I agree with everything she said. And we do, PERA does have support for the bill in every way. We'll talk specifically about three separate plans, our general plan, our police and fire plan, and our correctional plan, which collectively cover over 475,000 members. The board developed proposals for each of them, and the provisions that the board supported are in the bill, so the board is supporting these provisions. And these were supported broadly by our stakeholder groups. We have 12 different groups that provided support for these changes, including AFSCME 5, AFSCME 65, Teamsters 320, MMRA, the Public Employees Pension Service Association, League of Minnesota Cities, Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association, Law Enforcement Legal Services, and Minnesota Public Employees Association. So I think I covered them all. We're not aware of any group that will oppose these changes. And with the support of all the stakeholders, our board unanimously supported all of the provisions that were put into the bill for all three plans, as well as supporting the change in the investment return assumption to 7.5%, and, of course, all the administrative changes that we want to see changed as well. So very, very positive support for Senate File 2620 from our stakeholders and our board. And the ultimate result of this board is what really is repeatedly what we hear from our members is sustainability and security of benefits. And this bill helps provide that. We had three plans that were in the 70s and 80s in funding ratio currently. That's based on the more conservative 7.5% assumption and the market value of assets. But these plans were struggling to improve if there were no changes. They are all on a little bit of a path to improve, but very slightly, and certainly not what we would consider appropriate in the long run for where a funded level for plans should be. With these changes, all three of the plans would be expected to be fully funded within 21 years. And they get there in three different ways. And so I'd like to just cover a little bit how each plan achieved the ability to get on a path towards a fully funded within 21 years. With the police and fire plan, it comes by funding, additional funding. So it's 1% increase for the employees, 1.5% for the employers, phased in over 2 years, and the direct state aid, which is very helpful in supporting the stakeholder groups. With these changes, along with the elimination of the trigger, which would fix the COLA for police and fire at 1%. With those changes, we see the plan being on a path to be fully funded in 18 years. And it would put the 30-year funding ratio, improve it from an expected 92% up to close to 110%. So a very positive path, and again, supported by the stakeholders. And it also helps address some of the GASB volatility that we see as much more of an issue with our police and fire plan. With the general plan, there's a lot more work to do in the past year. A year ago, we were tasked with meeting a mandate of coming back with a proposal that would reflect the desired reforms, as well as meeting a minimum funding level. And we took that work seriously and talked to the stakeholders quite a bit about what options are available. We had some discussions with our board about kind of looking at the universe of options that are available in the plan design world. And we feel very positive about this proposal. It was based on a lot of interactions with all the stakeholder groups. We engaged with them early and often and came to what we think is a very good proposal that we are pleased to see in the bill that improves the funding status without any additional contributions. So no contributions from the employees, the employers, or state aid. It improves the funding status by reducing the annual required contribution by about 0.6% of pay, puts the plan on a path to be fully funded in 21 years, changes the expected funding ratio in the 30-year period from, it was expected to get up in the mid-90s, gets it up close to 110%. And it does this by also redistributing, a suggestion to redistribute the way that benefits are provided to the retirees into something that's more equitable. So we understood that the trigger we've known is problematic, and I think we first identified that as being a problem when it comes to funding. So recognizing that, well, if a plan has this trigger mechanism and you simply look to fund it by additional contributions or benefit changes in other areas. It just moves that trigger up, and you're on this treadmill, and you're not really making any progress. So we understood that that's problematic, but it was also problematic from a benefit perspective, that when it was first put in place back in 2010, I know there were good intentions. There was the belief that it wouldn't be a very long period before the trigger was triggered again, and the benefit increase would go to 2.5. That changed, and it resulted in this new benefit distribution approach, which is really quite different from one generation to another. So we looked at it as saying, well, there's a whole generation of retirees that we would see getting a 1% increase. And down the road in the future, when the plan reached 90% funding, there'd be a whole generation that would get 2.5% during their entire retirement. And, of course, there'd be a group in between that would be getting some of one and some of the other. But none of this tied to inflation. And so with that, there was a desire that, well, if there's a trigger approach, and this trigger has value because it was expected to occur, and the trigger date's been moving up, the board and the stakeholders wanted to look at, is there a better way than the trigger to address both cost efficiencies and benefit distribution issues? And that was how the approach to go to an inflation-based methodology started. So it started with the mandate to look at the reforms and meet cost parameters. First, we looked at what are the cost parameters for a post-retirement benefit. And we established that the value of the current trigger, if you convert that into a fixed rate, it would be a fixed rate of very close to 1.25% per year. So that was first step, 1.25% a year. And then with that, it was compared to, well, what is the assumed inflation rate? And the assumed inflation rate is 2.5% per year. So that's what the actuary provided to us. When they made a recommendation to go to a 7.5% assumption, embedded in that assumption is a 2.5% inflation assumption. So that's a long-term assumption. So knowing that the target for the cost parameters is 1.25% and the assumption is 2.5%, that's how we developed the 50% of inflation starting point. And it sounds nice and even. In part, it's just somewhat of a coincidence that that's how it turned out to be really pretty close to that 50%. In engaging with stakeholders, there was some concern about having a minimum or a floor, and the desire to have a 1% floor was put into the equation. And then with the desire to make sure we're controlling costs, there's a 1.5% cap on the equation. And so that was the result was a proposal to provide COLAs, post-retirement increases, prospectively that are equal to 50% of the consumer price index, the minimum of 1%, but a cap of 1.5%. So I think those are like training wheels on this approach, that really the amount can't be really outside those boundaries at the moment. And so what we believe this does on the benefit side is that it will more closely tie the benefits for retirees to inflation. The goal is to protect purchasing power, and this is a good way to do it. It's fairly common nationally for plans, public sector plans, that provide automatic increases to tie it to inflation, usually, again, with some type of floor and some type of cap. We think it's better for intergenerational equity, comparing one group of retirees with a future group of retirees. This would keep people closer to the desired inflation amount. And it's also consistent with Social Security. And that's part of the design was to, for example, when determining what index to use, what would be appropriate, the suggestion was to use the same index that Social Security uses when they make their announcement. So the approach would just, when Social Security makes their announcement, we would use that as the index and then key off of that to provide the communication and the adjustment to our retirees. And then there's also with the making sure we're containing costs by if inflation runs at a higher level. We're controlling that by keeping the cap at 1.5. If inflation is high, we'd see that cost come in. If inflation is low, we'd see some gains to the plan. And I think with that, there's some questions about the inflation base. I haven't talked about the correctional plan. The only change for our correctional plan is related to the COLA. It's just a little bit more complicated, but I think if there were questions about how we're proposing the post-retirement adjustment, I would welcome those.
Okay. Questions, members? Senator Dames.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you tell me, Mr. Anderson, what the current funding ratio is for the three plans?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Dames, yes, the current funding ratio for the general employees plan is 76%. For the police and fire plan, it's 86%. And for the correctional plan, it's 87%.
Thank you.
Questions? Anderson.
Okay, Madam Chair, moving on to the correctional plan, which covers about 1,000 retirees. This is similar to the general plan in which there are no additional costs in the proposal, so no employee increase, no employer increase, no state aid. The suggested approach, we believe, will improve the funding status either under good economic conditions or under poor economic conditions. And it does that by changing the current proposed post-retirement adjustment. Right now, there is this plan is relatively well-funded. It was funded enough for the 2.5% post-retirement adjustment to have triggered. So the retirees of this plan have been receiving the 2.5% increase for the last 3 or 4 years. And it's there. Many of them have the expectation to continue to receive that and a belief that the plan will continue to be well-funded. Now, the plan is 89 or 86% funded. There currently is a trigger-off mechanism, which says that if the plan were to fall below 85% funded for 2 consecutive years or under 80% funded once, that the current 2.5% would trigger off. And the benefit would increase would be 1%. The proposal that we're putting forward also uses the tie to inflation approach. It has one additional feature is to recognize that the plan could continue to stay in trigger on mode if the current assumptions are met or exceeded. And thus the current retirees could reasonably expect to continue to receive a 2.5% increase. And so our proposal is to continue to provide up to 2.5% as long as the plan stays in that positive zone of being above the trigger. So it's up to 2.5%. So that would be the cap. We'd propose still a floor of 1% and have the benefit be 100% of the consumer price index if in between there. So it still provides that opportunity for those members. But if the plan were to trigger off, drop below that threshold, then the cap would drop from 2.5% down to 1.5%. And that would immediately improve the funding direction of the plan. So it's a little bit more of a complicated measure to have this, but it does preserve the opportunity for retirees that if the plan stays in a positive position to provide inflation-based COLAs up to the 2.5% cap. And if the plan drops down in funding status, right away the plan would, the cap would be lowered and the funding status would improve immediately via the way the actuary does the calculation. And we'd expect this plan to go nearly to 100% funded right away and improve from that level.
So, Mr. Anderson, yeah. Questions, members? Good. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're done. I'm sorry. I was talking with Mr. Hellman, but you did a stellar job on this, Mr. Anderson. And I want to thank you for coming back to the table and coming up with a very, innovative approach to make sure that the board and our needs at the Pension Commission are met and that we are, this fund is sustainable ongoing. So, again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
And Ms. Erin Leonard, Executive Director for MSRS, please. Hello, Ms. Leonard. Welcome.
Good evening. Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Erin Leonard, Executive Director of MSRS. My testimony is going to probably be a little different. I'm not used to going last. A little closer, sorry.
Ooh, making me feel guilty.
No, that's okay. I'm not used to going last, so it's kind of, and I think I like going first. All this time, I didn't think I liked going first, but I really do. mental note. So thank you again for allowing us this time to comment on this important legislation. I had the opportunity to go to a conference the last couple of days with some of my colleagues around the country, and it just brings to mind the significance of the work that we do as plan administrators and plan sponsors, and gives me time to reflect when I'm not in the day-to-day office mode. And so it's perfect timing to speak to these topics. Tonight, I'd like to take a look back at the last few years and remind us how we got to this point and why action is so necessary to ensure the sustainability of our pension plans. The work that we do is very important, and the work that you do, both as commission members and staff that support the commission, is equally important. To some observers, the legislation discussed tonight may seem sudden or hurried, but the reality is that this bill is the result of more than 2 years of work. The MSRS story started in the fall of 2015 when the MSRS board developed a general plan proposal for consideration during the 2016 legislative session. The work continued in 2017 with the introduction of similar proposals for the general, correctional, and state patrol plans. These proposals were initiated primarily because our members are living longer, and we expect to see lower investment returns in the future. Recognizing this expensive reality is difficult but necessary. Keeping in mind that just changing to the 7.5 assumed rate of return increases our liabilities by $920 million. So that is a significant increase in those liabilities. The board proposal last year included reducing the assumed rate of return from 8 to 7.5%, increasing employee and employer contributions, reamortization, and reductions to cost of living adjustments for our retirees, both current retirees and our future retirees as well. The legislation in front of you includes many of these components proposed by the board, in addition to benefit reforms proposed by the commission. The MSRS provisions in Senate File 2620, House File 3053, are virtually identical to the bill that passed the Senate unanimously at the end of the 2017 legislative session. The changes include reamortization for all of our plans, lowering the investment assumption, increasing employer contributions for the general, unclassified, correctional, and state patrol plans. It also includes variations of COLA reductions for retirees and increased employer contributions. Additional benefit modifications in this bill that will affect former, current, and future active employees include the removal of deferred augmentation and elimination of COLA adjustments prior to normal retirement age. Eliminating future deferred augmentation affects both active and inactive members in all plans. And as you are aware, I just want to reiterate that MMB does have some concerns about the elimination of this deferred augmentation entirely and would prefer to study this benefit. Generally, our stakeholders are supportive of this legislation, and I expect you will hear from them next week. I think it's important to note that the savings generated by the benefit modifications and COLA reductions actually reduce our plan liabilities by $1.2 billion. So it does have a significant impact. I'd also like to reiterate my gratitude to the chair and the commission for including the governor's proposal for the MSRS correctional and state patrol plans by both including the supplemental contributions and funding them. The public employees covered by these plans ensure our safety as Minnesota citizens, and these additional contributions will significantly improve the health of these plans and sustain them long into the future. In conclusion, this proposed legislation included for MSR's plans in Senate File 2620, House File 3053, eliminates contribution deficiencies in the general correctional and state patrol plans, and our actuarial projections actually indicate that these plans will reach or exceed 100% funding within the amortization period. Without action, the plans are projected to be 58%, 56%, and 76% funded, respectively. So just making these changes, it really does improve the trajectory of these plans tremendously. Again, thank you for your work that you've done over the last 2 years to ensure that nearly 130,000 MSRS members will have sustainable retirement plans into the future.
Thank you, Ms. Leonard. Are there any questions? Ms. Leonard. Actually, you did really well at the end. I mean, you did good being last.
Thank you.
It was great. Thank you. Ms. Leonard, do you want to just go through the MSRS unclassified changes that were in the bill, please? Because those are new, and that is something that had to be done.
Yes. So the currently in statute, the MSRS unclassified contributions for the employee contribution are tied to the general plan. So and part of that is because the unclassified plan members that are employees, not elected officials, have the opportunity to change to the general plan under certain conditions, depending on their hire date. Ms. Lincheski did some, at last year's legislation actually disconnected those contributions. So the legislation last year kept the unclassified employee contributions at 5.5%, and the general plan was slowly ratcheting up to 6% for the employee contributions. Ms. Lincheski did some research over the summer regarding the employer pickup provisions. So the IRS code 414H, I can't remember which section, allows for the employer pickup of the employee contributions to be pre-tax if there's something stated in statute. Because the unclassified plan contributions are linked and those two plans are linked, the unclassified employee contribution does need to remain the same as the general plan contribution. In addition, currently the unclassified contribution is 6% for the employer, and just to be the same, it was suggested that they increase the employer contribution as well to 6.25%. So the contributions to both plans will be the same after everything is implemented.
Great. Questions, Ms. Leonard, on that? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nice job. Thank you to all the directors. With that, there are no further questions. I am going to turn over to Mr. Nauman, and he is going to go over the spreadsheet. Members, you did have the fiscal note that was sent to you through your email. I don't believe it's in the packet.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding there are copies if you would like them handed out.
Yes. We can do that. Why don't we hand that? We can do that. And Mr. Nauman, what sheet are you going to work on?
Madam Chair and members, I think it might be useful to orient commission members to three documents that I'm going to use for the purposes of talking about the appropriations, and that's frankly my purpose here today is to talk about what will be funded. There is a spreadsheet in the packet. My version is yellow. I think yours is black and white. Senate File 2620 Omnibus Pension Bill appropriation tracking in the upper left-hand corner. It's a portrait-oriented document with a spreadsheet and Senate CRFA on the upper right-hand corner. That's one document. Then Senate File SCS 2620A-1 amendment, and then the fiscal note. And I'll just look to see if commission members have those documents before I go too much further.
Three documents.
Thank you, Senator. So, Madam Chair and members, perhaps it's helpful for me to begin with the fiscal note because I think that, at least in terms of my end of this work, it began really with the fiscal note. And I do want to extend special thanks to MMB and MDE for their assistance in this. They did a very quick turnaround and enabled me to have a document in front of you that will actually put numbers into the bill. Members, the fiscal note is labeled Senate File 9037. This is essentially a way that we could, as fiscal staff, trick the fiscal note system into producing a fiscal note before we actually had the bill language introduced. But it is
It is a bill. It is a fiscal note on the Senate file 2620.
And I will, for the purposes of this discussion, members, only be concentrating on the first three numbers under each of the fiscal years. So, Department of Education did a pricing of the pension adjustment formula, and those are the first three lines there. They priced that formula at $12 million in fiscal 19, and then growing all the way up through $36 million in fiscal 21. There will be changes to that number on the spreadsheet, and I'll identify how those change when we go through the spreadsheet. Then MMB did some work on both general fund dollars and non-general fund dollars of 20.4 in 19, growing to 40 million in 21, and then the non-general fund dollars are 6.6 and 14.5. The first thing I'll reference is that the fiscal note was produced with an assumption based on a 10-year average of salaries, over, and that number was 2.7% annually. So the fiscal note inflated salaries into the future from fiscal 17 to 18 and 18 into 19 by 2.7%. And there was some feeling when we produced, when decisions were being made, that that may have been a slightly aggressive number. And so the spreadsheet that you will see, or that's in your packet, inflates covered salaries by first 2% from 17 into 18, and then from 18 into 19 by 2.25%. And all the numbers get recomputed based on that. So while the fiscal note tells you what the price for agencies are, the proposal that's being put in front of the commission today is for paying for that at a slightly lower level, primarily first based on that assumption. That's the first item. And the chair reminds me, and in subsequent years, similar to the fiscal note, it's flat after that. So to the extent that there are any increases, that would be paid for at the time, and it would be part of an overall proposal. The other thing that I will highlight for members that differs from the fiscal note is that there were four entities that in last year were not covered. And those four entities, in other words, the pension costs were extended to these entities, but the bill did not actually pay for them. And those entities are the University of Minnesota, MNSCU, the Met Council, and the Historical Society. The proposal on the in the spreadsheet also does not make that change. I mean, it does not make those payments. So those are the primary differences for MSRS. I will also, I mentioned previously that the spreadsheet books a slightly lower number for the general education pension adjustment, and that is primarily because when the bill was drafted, it was assumed that under the K-12 formulas, this formula would be part of the general education formula, similar to compensatory aid or the general education basic formula allowance. This will be a component of general education. That appropriation is shifted, and on the payment schedule, this language was originally drafted as unshifted, so it would be 100% paid in the first year. The proposal in front of you and the amendment incorporates a suggestion from the chair that be added to the payment, that it be shifted. So it would be paid 90% in the first year and then a lagging payment of 10% in the subsequent year. So, Madam Chair, with your permission and that as background, I will move on to the appropriation tracking.
Members, any questions for Mr. Nauman before we...
Conceptually.
Representative Murphy.
Chair, Mr. Nauman, would you go over those four things, the U of M, MNSCU, the Historical Society, and what was the other one?
Madam Chair and Representative, the fourth one was the Metropolitan Council.
So effectively what removing those does is pull down some of the costs relative to the prices that are displayed in the fiscal note.
Okay, and then will you explain in different words this time what change will take place in ed finance?
Certainly.
K-12, early childhood 12 through 12th grade. How will it be paid for and how will it be noted on their spreadsheets?
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I'm not sure whose spreadsheets you're referencing.
The spreadsheets from the Senate and the House.
On the K-12 spreadsheets?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I expect that they will not be shown on the K-12 spreadsheets, but they will be aligned to this bill. There will be a spreadsheet that travels with this bill that will recognize those costs if the Chair's proposal is something that the Commission ultimately adopts. That's the first piece. The second piece is what is the difference between the fiscal note and how the Department of Education modeled the prices of the pension adjustment versus what's being done here? And if this gets quickly into the K-12 finance, but what I will suggest to you is that the amount of money that school districts will receive as a result of the pension adjustment, it's basically covered salaries multiplied times by a rate that's in the bill. That does not change. It's a question of when we appropriate the money. And under the K-12 shifting process, the suggestion here is that 90% of that first year's payment will be the appropriation. In the second year, the appropriation will be 90% of that year's formula added to a 10% lagging payment from the prior year. So essentially you're pushing 10% of that appropriation from the current year into the subsequent year. It's a process that is called the K-12 shift, and it has some historic, you probably could educate me better than anyone about how long this has been around, but functionally it allows the Department of Education to clean up pupil counts at the very end. And because this is part of the, at the end of the fiscal year, because this is part of the overall K-12 finance formula, it seemed appropriate and cleaner and easier to administer to treat this formula the way most other K-12 formulas are treated.
And Madam Chair, Mr. Nauman.
Representative Murphy.
Will the state representative or the state senator be able to go home and talk to their local school boards about the funding for pensions to the local school board as part of the, will they be talking as part of the per pupil unit funding for the students for the pensions? Will that come out of the per pupil funding or will that be a separate category?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, it's a separate category. It is not part of the per pupil formula.
Okay.
This particular formula is a rate multiplied times the covered salary. That rate is the exact rate that the various plans have as part of the overall package that they will experience. The employer, the school district in this case, will have increased contribution levels, and that's the exact rate that the K-12 formula will provide them. What I was describing was when that gets paid to them, and that occurs over 2 years.
Right, and it would be the 90% and then the 10% based on the number of pupils that are signed up for that school district.
Madam Chair, Nauman. Representative Murphy, I'm only hiccuping there because this is not a per pupil based formula.
Right.
It's based on salaries.
Representative Murphy.
Okay.
This is the difference, Representative Murphy. And this was a call I needed to make on to get this fiscal note out before the budget forecast. Get our stake in the ground, but this is a very good conversation because, as it was last year, as you know, it was on the per pupil formula.
Yeah.
and now it is on the basically how many employees will be eligible for pensions at that school district.
And that particular year?
In that
particular, in the coming particular
right.
years?
Yes. Okay. And as you know, members, Mr. Naumann was in education 45 years or so on in the research level. At least.
Madam Chair, I don't think that was quite that long.
It was a long time ago. I always say there's only two people in the state that know the per pupil formula. He's one of them, and Mr. Belcher's one of them.
Okay. Melcher's the other.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Before I give, Madam Chair, Mr. Naumann, then was this passed by the School Boards Association?
Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair and Representative Murphy, I can't speak to that point.
Okay, Madam Chair.
I don't know.
Okay. Yeah. Representative Murphy, would you like Mr. Stoffel, Executive Director, to come up and talk on this issue?
The stakeholder support.
Mr. Stoffel.
Well, I don't know that Mr. Stoffel knows what the School Board Association thinks. Did you talk to the School Board Association, Madam Chair?
I have
on this
talked
issue?
To them. And then you have the School Administrators Association, and you have a lot of different opinions out there, Representative Murphy. And
okay.
I think that's just something. This is where we need to have the discussion.
Okay,
absolutely. Mr. Stoffel, do you have anything to add to this discussion?
Madam Chair, no, I don't.
Okay.
But I was called up, so I had to come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas. Madam Chair, I think this idea was in the governor's proposal last year, so it certainly has been out there. The advantage I see, and we've done this pension, what's it called? Pension adjustment before, Mr. Naumann informs me. The advantage I see is that it's very clear that it's almost like I'm submitting a bill for my pension costs, and I'm being paid for my pension costs directly in a separate mechanism, so it doesn't get mixed in with the school aid formula and money in the classroom and, you know, mixed up like that. So I think it's an excellent idea. I had a very short question for Mr. Naumann. I was just curious, are we still doing shifting in school aids? Are we still doing 90-10 or anything?
Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the answer is yes. There is a shift in place, and there are good reasons why that exists. We are at 90-10, and by custom and practice, we have always considered that to be unshifted.
Okay, got it.
And members, I'll be honest. It's going to look like Greater Minnesota schools are not going to be getting as much as the metro schools on this issue. But it is actually very fair, the way the calculation of the formula does work. Representative Murphy.
Just for greater comfort, Madam Chair, how long is Senator Pappas correct that this has been out there that long? And, I mean, this is the first I've had this explained to me in this manner.
Mr. Naumann.
Madam Chair, and Representative Murphy, it's my understanding that the governor's recommendation included some form of a pension form adjustment that is very similar to this. Of course, there are different numbers that reflect the agreement that I have come to understand. The difference between the governor's initiative last year, the proposal that was brought by the governor, and this, I would say, is that in that form, it was funded 100% current as opposed to the 90-10 payment schedule.
And
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, I'm reacting in the sense that we didn't discuss this at all in Education Finance Committee, the pension part.
Okay.
And so this is going to take some more explanation, and I don't know if we can fit it in between now and next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Well, but it is what it is.
Thank you for bringing it up tonight.
I don't think, Representative Murphy, I don't think it was part of the discussion last year because there was, it was already decided it was going to go on the per pupil formula. So it was not really part of the discussion at all. But I do. You know, if that's the will of the commission to put her on the per pupil, I just had to make this judgment call, and I went with it because it was seamless. And I will say back to what the governor's Blue Ribbon Commission and the recommendations that came out. I'm sure there is some questions, some thoughts about not including the University of Minnesota, MinSCU, Historical Society, and MnDOT, or Met Council. And those were also not in the governor's recommendations, and that was what the bill. We did not have those in the bill last year too. So we're just stating in the bill that is not covered. So I want to make that clear that I'm just not. I didn't make a decision on that. That was already decided on last year. I'm just clarifying it in the bill. Mr. Nauman?
So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, and...
You owe me money. We've got a bet going. How many times he calls me Mr. Chair?
Madam Chair,
I
believe that only applied to the Finance Committee. I'm not sure it applies to Madam Chair and members, with your permission, I'll just kind of step through the prices that are displayed on the spreadsheet, again, titled Senate File 2620 Omnibus Pension Bill. Fiscal 2019, the first three or four numbers there display the costs for MSRS employer contributions. Again, this would be one of the numbers primarily where the elimination of those four component units that we talked about previously would have been displayed had they been included. That price is now $6.7 million and escalates to a biennial effect of 30.7. Madam Chair and members, skipping down to line 15, there are some TRA employer contributions that are borne by primarily the education departments, plural intentionally, so the Department of Education, the State Academies, and the Perpich Center. Not significant costs, but there are a few employees there that are TRA members, and the changes in the TRA generate increased costs for their agencies. And so there's $32,000 collectively in 18-19 and increasing to $161,000. It was previously discussed and is displayed on line 23, the direct aid payments. This is $5 million annually for the St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund Association and PERA Police and Fire. Those are displayed in the bill in Article 8 and are on the spreadsheet lines 23 through 27. There's an increase in PERA Police and Fire growing up to $9 million in fiscal 21. Madam Chair and members, on line 30 is the general education pension adjustment, which we've spent a fair bit of time about. This number would be directly analogous to the number displayed on the very first group of numbers on the fiscal note. So by putting that appropriation or that entitlement on the 90-10 payment schedule, it drops from a $12 million appropriated value in fiscal 19 down to 10.863. So, Madam Chair and members, on line 36, that displays the total general fund effect of $27.2 million in fiscal 18-19, and then in 20 and 21, $113.5. There's also some non-general fund costs associated with the proposals in front of you, or the bill, almost $6.6 million in 18-19. These numbers also are affected by the slightly lower growth assumption. So the fiscal note would show a little bit higher numbers, but the proposal in front of you is to appropriate $6.6 million, and then the tail would be $27.3 million. Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll step through the changes on the A1 amendment.
Mr. Nauman.
And then that would conclude what I have. I'm looking for eyes and nods that everyone has that before, because I'd like to go through this line by line. Thank you, Senator. So, Madam Chair, line 1.2 of the amendment eliminates the aid payment schedule changes that would have put the pension
the pension adjustment formula on 100% current funded, and by default eliminating that section leaves it on, puts it back on a 90-10 payment schedule, and that's the basis that the other pension adjustment formulas are appropriated under current law. Lines 1.3, 1.4, 1.7, and 1.8 add money into the MSRS appropriations, and they conform to the spreadsheet. Line 1.4 on advice from counsel, we do a slight technical change to some of the structure of the appropriation language. Madam Chair, one thing that I neglected to describe previously when walking through some of the changes that were discussed, the proposal in front of the commission is to appropriate the judiciary, the legislative, and the executive branch employer contributions in a single appropriation, actually two appropriations, one general fund and one non-general fund. So in those occasions where you see the judicial branch, we are adding the judicial branch into the appropriation so that it will occur all, so that the executive, the judicial, and the legislative are all appropriated. That occurs on line 1.5 in the first occasion. Line 1.9 is technical to conform with the changes that are occurring on line 1.12 and 1.14. With a little bit of research, it was felt that it would be best if there was a desire to exclude the University of Minnesota, Minn State, the Metropolitan Council, and the Historical Society, that the appropriation explicitly state, or the language of the appropriation specifically state that they were excluded. So lines 1.12 through 1.14 make that change by adding a paragraph onto the general fund appropriation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Nauman,
on that point, would you just tell us what those what that contribution would have been if they had been included for each of those entities?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, the general fund value for each of the entities would be as follows. In fiscal 19, the Met Council would have received $1 million. The Historical Society, $23,000. This is just the general fund. The University of Minnesota, $1.677. And Minnesota State, $893,000. Obviously, those appropriations would increase somewhat in the tails, and I can provide you the general fund tails if you want those as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Nauman?
Line 1.5 is technical. Line 1.16 and 1.17 bring the judicial branch, and we omitted the legislature. So to the point that I discussed earlier, line 1.18 deletes the separate appropriation for the judicial branch. It's no longer necessary now that the judicial branch is included in the overall larger appropriation. Lines 1.19 through 1.29 bring in the appropriations to TRA. Again, this is the education agencies, MBE, the Perpich Center, and the academies. Those appropriations and base levels are added all the way through the subsequent page, lines 2.7. Line 2.8 and 2.9 delete the blanks and insert the general education appropriation that's attributable to the pension adjustment formula, again, that being the 90% number. So, Madam Chair, that was a lot, but I think that's all that I had, unless there were questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nauman. Very well done. Questions, members? That is a lot to digest. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Nauman, just to get an idea of the scope of everything, so we're looking at about $160 million on the biennial basis. So over the 30-year period, how much are we going to be spending out of direct aids for the state and out of the general fund for this?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Nelman.
Over a 30-year period, I would have to do some quick math. If you give me a little bit of time, I can mock something up, but it wouldn't be precise.
That's why I asked you rather than me. Thank you.
If you give me a few minutes, I can probably do something.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Nelman.
Members, anything else? How long do you need?
Are we done?
Out.
Yes, you actually are.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, can I clarify? Are you just interested in general fund, or are you looking at non-general fund as well?
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Nelman, both. And if it makes it easier, if you can at least give me a 5-year period, and then you can get back to me on the 30-year period.
Sure.
Bill.
5 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll, do you have any comments, thoughts, questions?
Madam Chair, thank you. And I want to start out this evening by thanking the executive directors for being here tonight with us and for helping lead the charge and the effort on what's been a 3-plus year, I would say, endeavor, this being the third year, and the stakeholder groups for recognizing that this is a team effort. You saw that there's going to be some pretty significant investment that's being requested on behalf of the state of Minnesota and the general fund budget. We stay committed to wanting to find a reasonable solution to this, and we appreciate the work that nonpartisan staff has done, as well as partisan staff, to be able to help us to get where we are today. And we know that we still have a finish line a ways ahead of us on this bill. And we also know that Governor Dayton needs to be a player in this as well. And I've invited the commissioner from MMB to be a part of the discussions and the negotiation to try to increase the successes of getting a bill signed by the governor this year. Senator Pappas knows as well as anyone that she and I had started this process back in 2016, where the veto pen started hitting pension bills, and they were bipartisan, they were bicameral, and that same effort has been viewed and seen in the last year, and we're again attempting to get this across the finish line. So, Madam Chair, we do know we've got some work ahead of us, but I think we are moving in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And you are spot on with your comments. It just was asking, and I'm sure there's folks out here that could probably should bring up Mr. Rice. When was the last time we had a contribution from the employers into the funds? It's been a very long time. And last great reform was 2010, and I can't remember too much action since that time. So it's overdue. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I really applaud you and the Vice Chair for putting together this bill. And, nothing is perfect, and there are compromises that have to be made. I do think that, to be fair, in 2016, we didn't have everyone on board with that bill. We wanted to get started with reform, and we couldn't get all the way, so we tried to get there partway, and the governor didn't agree. So last year there was a problem with, I think, the pension got mixed up with some other issues. So this year I think if we can keep a clean bill, independent from other issues, and not have linkage with other issues, I think that's going to be our best chance for success.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Thank you for your work on that, too, Senator Pappas. Done a great job. And Representative Murphy, you could probably tell us how long it's been since we've put any money. How long have you been on pensions, Representative Murphy?
Not long enough
to have. Oh, I'm scared now.
Madam Chair, we should look forward.
Yes,
we try to do our best.
Exactly. Exactly. Thank you. I appreciate that. I as you all know, we are all, I think, very committed to this pension reform and to the work that has occurred over the last 3 years.
there's a lot of work going forward, and I'll be honest, I wasn't feeling good this afternoon when I saw the fiscal note. It's been, I mean, it's a chunk of money, but it's also a commitment, and it's something that I'm glad we have this out the night before our forecast comes in tomorrow, and I think we should make a priority to our caucus members. I really do. So, Mr. Nauman, Senator Sundjian.
Madam Chair, can we just, for my benefit at least, a little clarity? I'm noticing on this card the dates of March 6th and March 13th. Is the intention to, what's the intention? I thought I heard that we were going to take this bill up next week. What is the March 13th meeting about?
Thank you, Senator Sundjian. March 6th will be public testimony and any amendments, adjustments to the bill, discussion by the commission, and I am open to how you guys would like to do that going forward until next Tuesday. If you have some amendments that you that we could discuss before we a public display, but we can certainly talk about it. My office is always open, and Representative Driscoll and Senator Pappas and Representative Murphy, absolutely. And then March 13th, Senator Sundjian is the vote out of committee. I believe the next day it would go in on the Senate side to State Gov, and then on the House side, and on to Finance. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did we adopt the A1 amendment? Was your intention to adopt that tonight or not?
No.
Okay.
No. Mm-mm. Senator Sundjian.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, would there be any amendments on March 13th?
I think okay. there should be. Yeah, absolutely. Representative Murphy.
And then, Chair, Mr. Nauman, what is Mr. Nauman's availability between now and March 6th?
Mr. Nauman.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, I work for the Senate, and by extension, the House. So, whatever you need.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I'll attempt to commit some fiscal malpractice and give you a 30-year number. There's a lot of problems with what I've just done, but I will give you basically what I have. I have some confidence going out through 2025, so that would be the first 7 years. I think the general fund number is about $421.9 million going out that far. And the non-general fund would be an additional $81 million, so the total would be about $503.4 million. That leaves under, we'll call it Representative Anderson's challenge, some mechanism to come up with the remaining 23 years. And I just took the last year and multiplied it out by 22. There's a lot of problems, or 23 rather. There's a lot of problems with doing that, most specifically in the K-12 formulas, with lots of changes in pupil counts that'll be growing. And so I think once you get beyond the time horizon that I've given you so far, it becomes problematic. That adds about general fund. If you commit that malpractice that I described, you get an additional 2.4 for those in general fund, for the 2.4 billion for the general fund, and an additional 364.8 million in the non-general fund for about 2.8 billion for those 22 years. So all in, all years, all funds, 3.291. But again, with a lot of caveats.
Reality check. Yeah. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Members, also, Ms. Lincheski reminded me that we have 6 individual bills next week. If you have anything else that needs to be heard, can you please let Ms. Barth and Ms. Lincheski know that? We will try to get that on the docket. So public testimony next week, amendments, personal bills, and if we need to continue on, or it may go longer than what we normally do, but we'll push this forward. I'd like to have this out by the 13th. Any further questions, comments? Thank you very much, members. Thank you to all of you out there, too. Meeting is adjourned.